Well, should we start with some of the basics to refresh our own memories? I'm sure our listeners know all the basics already, but maybe refresh my memory. So Pontius Pilate, then, who is he, and what role does he play within the Gospels or the Passion narrative?
He was the Roman prefect of Judea.
Very good, prefect. Correct, not procurator.
Well, I mean, the fact that his prefect only came to light quite recently, I think.
Yes, the Pilate stone.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
For listeners that are already frustrated, to explain.
You've gone in pretty hard there.
The procurator is both prefect and procurator are a Roman terms for people that governed areas of the Roman Empire. I think that procurators came in under Claudius is something that I've seen. I'm not an expert on this, but prefect has more military connotations. So it refers to the fact that Judea was not at the time, I hope I'm right in saying this, this is under the reign of Tiberius, a province. Instead, it's a sort of military district, a sort of satellite of Syria, which is a province, a military, a powerful military province. There is some meaning to that. The prefect title is a more militaristic title in its nuance. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
And came under Syria, I think, in the hierarchy.
Mm. Oh, yeah, certainly, yeah.
Although there was no consul of Syria for a lot of Pilate's time.
Do you mean proconsul?
Maybe.
Mm. There's two consuls there in Rome.
I knew that. Mm. Yeah, proconsul.
Mm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
So that was the role held by Pilate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We sort of know existed through this Pilate stone, as you've said. There's an inscription with his name. He appears on some coins as well.
Mm-hmm. He's definitely a real person because, I mean, they found this stone in Caesarea Maritima, which is the administrative capital of the province. It's on the coast. Which is where he would have based himself almost certainly. There's a stone. It's fragmentary, but it's got Pilatus in full on it. So, and it's pretty dead cert that it's him. You know, the dating is right. And it says, you know, Pontius Pilate dedicated this stone to, I think it's to Tiberius Caesar. It was being reused in a different building, but they found it in the 60s. So there's that. He's also mentioned in Josephus, Tacitus, and Philo of Alexandria. So it's pretty clear that this is a historical
character. And Tacitus, it's only a brief mention that he had Jesus killed. But there's some theories that there are a couple of missing books of Tacitus that would have gone into more detail.
Mm.
Absolutely a real guy. And actually, you can kind of situate him quite firmly in Roman history. We can see a few other people from the Pontius or the Pontii family in Roman history, including one of the assassins of Caesar, Pontius Aquila.
Mm. Didn't know that.
Who was tribune of the plebs. So that again indicates that, although this was a noble family, equestrian class, they had come up from plebeian status at some point.
Yeah, so equestrian is for all of those Roman purists out there, equestrian is... It's very, very wealthy and powerful, but it's not quite the what would be known as the nobiles or the senatorial elite. So it's not the absolute prime tier of the Roman aristocracy. It's more like the kind of administrative, financial classes. You know, the magnates. You know, the owners of great banking houses. The doers, the shakers, the movers, the guys who are making the money. Quite often they're the equestrians.
Yeah. What else can we learn? So looking at his name as well. So Pontius is his family name. We don't know his first name. And then we got Pilate or Pilatus, which is a nickname or a cognomen, meaning skilled with the javelin.
Mm.
And it is likely that he gained that nickname himself by being skilled with the javelin.
Mm.
So by being an excellent soldier.
You know what? I've only really read about this today, you know, in anticipation of what we were talking about, but he comes across as a military, in the very few fragments we have that actually describe what he gets up to, he comes across to me as a military man in what he does.
And he could only have had that job really with some substantial military experience.
Yeah, definitely.
And the favour of Tiberius, I think.
Yeah, especially that particular job. So it's not just the job of prefect, which, as I've said, has a military nuance to it, but the particular job of prefect of Judea. You know, Judea is not some kind of like cozy posting where everything's fine. You know, it's not it's not the Roman equivalent of the home counties. Judea is one of those provinces that you know, requires a firm hand, probably, from the perspective and, of the centre.
To this day.
No comment.
What else do you know about him? So he was in post for probably close to a decade before getting recalled by Tiberius.
Yes, well, it's an interesting story. He puts down a revolt. And the locals who have felt the sharp end of his sword, as it were, appeal to the chap in Syria who outranks him. I think he's called Vitellius, if I remember rightly. And Vitellius decides to send him to answer to Tiberius in Rome, basically in order to have his conduct sort of assessed by the emperor, basically. So not quite a trial, but as good as, in many ways, more dangerous than a trial when we're dealing with Tiberius.
Probably going to have a bad day.
It's very, very, it's highly uncertain as to what type of day you're going to have. But I think that Tiberius dies before he gets there. And I think the consensus is that, therefore, he probably just went into retirement after that.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got nothing else.
Yeah. So that's what we know about him. Let's go and talk about your points then. Remind us again of your points in order of why he's an interesting person to discuss in this context of Easter.
Well, of course, what we haven't discussed is his specific actions around Jesus.
Yeah, you're right. There's that. small details. Yes, what are the small details in his interactions with this chap called Jesus?
Yeah, so this comes to us through the Gospels. So this is four broadly independent accounts of Jesus' life. And basically, Jesus had come to notice of the Jews, the Sadducees, I think, who were, and specifically the priests. And I think in some of the Gospels, it's when he cleansed the temple of the money changers that it kind of upset the religious hierarchy. And in John, it's when he raised, Lazarus from the dead. Which, you know, freaked people out a bit. And so the religious authorities saw him as very dangerous. And so one night after the Last Supper, after Gethsemane and all that, he was captured by the high priest Caiaphas and his goons. Kept there overnight, I think, beaten and tormented. But the religious authorities didn't have the power to actually punish him or kill him. So they caught this dangerous man.
I think that's quite a controversial point, isn't it? What powers they did have. I've certainly read that they did have the power to condemn to death by stoning or something like this, but that what happens to Jesus, you know, the crucifixion is a distinctively Roman. They wouldn't have been permitted to do that. That's a Roman calling card, as it were.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's important context that the local rulers had a lot of power here. So it wasn't that the prefect had absolute power over Judea. He was working alongside the high priest. He was working alongside Tetrarch like Herod.
Yeah, the Romans quite often, and especially at this quite early point of the Roman Empire, would leave the local structures of power and control in place and just sort of put a Roman governor or a Roman military prefect on the top of that pre-existing structure. It's a much cheaper, an easier way to manage a hugely expanded empire when your administrative capacity and so forth is struggling to keep up, as it were.
Well, I mean, there's a parallel with the British Empire. I think that's how we ran India all the time.
Yeah.
Very small number of Brits and local power structures pretty much intact.
Yeah. So there's this religious court, I think, is it the Sanhedrin? Which Caiaphas is, you know, effectively the head of, isn't it? But somehow Pilate himself gets involved in this, doesn't he? So this is
they bring Jesus to Pilate.
Which suggests that not at all. And that suggests that Jesus is a is an interesting and significant figure, because if the local authorities are not willing to do away with him before taking him to the Roman prefect, that in itself suggests that they are conscious of certain political sensitivities, or that there is that the Roman military authorities have already taken an interest, or that they think that it is that Jesus's actions and his profile or whatever put him in the category of someone who needs to be referred to the Romans. So it might imply, I don't know, insurrection.
Well, yeah, especially, I mean, yeah, the actual crimes they sort of accuse him with. I mean, one of them was telling people not to pay their taxes or something like that, because one of the stories of his ministry is some priest trying to catch him out, saying, should we pay taxes?
Because it's a render unto Caesar, yeah. But I think that it's quite telling, isn't it, that in the Gospels that we could get this detail, you know, he's the king of the Jews. That's what's put in above his crucifix. And there's a lot of sort of back and forth repartee about whether he's king or the king of the Jews or not with Pilate. And so that claim to sovereignty, to put it in a in that way, is probably what has triggered the Roman involvement, because of course the Romans are quite clear that, you know, they are sovereign. So if someone comes along saying, no, actually I'm king of the Jews, and the Romans say, no you're not, that's a Roman matter.
And then in Pilate's interrogation of Jesus that follows, like, that is one of the main themes, as you say, and he said, how are you king of the Jews? And the different Gospels kind of play it differently, whether Jesus says, yes, I am, or this is what you say. But the other point he makes is that my kingdom is not of this world. And so Pilate kind of says, okay, well, there is therefore no conflict, because, we're only interested with power in this world. But as you say, there's a lot of back and forth, an intriguing back and forth, as Pilate tries to make up his mind or try and find a crime that, you know, he can proceed with the punishment of, and then trying to get Jesus out of it. There's that dialogue, what is truth?
Yeah,
in Luke Pilate asks him at one point.
In the Gospel of Luke, he says, doesn't he, I'll just flog him. But he hasn't done anything wrong. But I'll just give him a flogging and then I'll let him go. I mean, he says this a number of times.
Because he seems to have come and go from the interrogation room into the sort of courtyard, sort of trying to negotiate between the religious authorities and then going back to Jesus. And
he tries a sort of jurisdictional trick as well, doesn't he? Because he asks him, are you from Galilee? And Jesus goes, yes, I am from Galilee. He goes, oh, great, I can send you off to Herod then, because Herod is technically in charge of Galilee. Galilee is actually outside of Pontius Pilate's jurisdiction, so he thinks, oh, brilliant, I can just send him to Herod, and it's not my problem anymore. But the problem is Herod sends him back.
And it seems the two didn't have an easy relationship. Not much mutual respect.
So Herod just played that one with a straight bat. Probably much to Pilate's chagrin.
Not touching that.
So it does seem that Pilate didn't want to kill him. If we're to take the Gospels at face value, it seems that he was quite keen to find a compromise or find a way of fudging the issue. For which I believe Pontius is fairly well respected in some denominations of Christianity.
In Ethiopian church, I think he's a saint, because he clearly didn't want to do this. And was just put in a difficult situation.
I think in Coptic Christianity as well, I think that there's there's a feast day of his wife as well.
Well, she has an interesting walk on role in this as well. I think in Luke again, the next phase is that it's the Passover, and Pilate says he's told there's a tradition that he can release one prisoner. Who do you want it to be? Jesus or Barabbas the murderer? And they will...
everyone cries, give us Barabbas. Give us Barabbas.
But just before he says that, his wife comes over to him and says, don't have any part in this. I had a bad dream about this. Just stay out of it. And I think writers over the ages have kind of expanded on what this dream might have been. And this gets to my wider question of why he's in the Nicene Creed, because so some of the fictional retellings of this dream are that she's just heard literally billions of people saying, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, under Pontius Pilate, under Pontius Pilate for thousands of years.
So it's a,
name echoes on.
She's dreamt of the millions of recitations of the creed from that moment forth.
Yeah, is a story that's been written about. But she had a dream that was negative and said, stay out of it.
Yeah, not an unusual thing in the ancient world, people to have dreams and that guide their actions quite explicitly and unapologetically.
Yeah, so, and then ignoring them often doesn't end well.
Yes.
As we see in this case.
Yes. Should we read the Nicene Creed? Just so that... and then we could read the Apostles' Creed as well. So here's the Nicene Creed, originally written in Greek. We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is, seen and unseen. We believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only Son of God, eternally begotten of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father. Through him all things were made. For us, men, and for our salvation, he came down from heaven by the power of the Holy Spirit. He became incarnate of the Virgin Mary and was made man. For our sake, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He suffered death and was buried. That's about halfway through the creed, but that's the relevant bit, isn't it? So we can probably pause there. And then in the Apostles' Creed, we have, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his Son, our only Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended into hell, and on the third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven. Now, interesting, this is one of the things that caught my attention. I'm just going to put a note in, put a pin in here, that I looked at the original Latin, and it said that he descended into hell. What the Latin says is descended ad inferos, which basically means he descended to the world below, the infernal realms, which when you have the context of that word in Latin literature, it doesn't quite mean hell.
Yep. It's different.
It's different, yeah.
Well, I think a lot of this stuff, I'm not saying it suffers under translation, but in translating something, you are going to change it.
Yeah.
Like Latin and Greek in particular has a lot of precision around some terms that English doesn't have, and vice versa, where we have to choose a specific interpretation because we don't have the general word.
It's just there's a lot of that.
I remember I took some beginner Greek classes at uni, and very early in the course, we were given Mark's Gospel as our homework.
Yep.
And, used to King James version of the Bible, the English translation, which is quite opaque, poetic, deliberately archaic, like beautiful, but you wouldn't say clear and easy, like it's not something you'd give a beginner student as their homework. But the Greek of Mark was very simple,
very easy,
very clear, very direct, and I think we can forget that about a lot of biblical language, in that this was very simple, very clear.
I mean, the King James Bible is in many ways a sort of remix. It's a rewriting. It's not quite a remix, but it's a significant improvement upon the original.
Well, yeah, and it's partly meant as a kind of ritual text, where like the phrasing, the repetition, the thing, like it kind of gets you into a hypnotic state. Like it's a very effective religious text, but it is not clear and simple.
No. Good. Okay. So, but in both of those creeds, then we have he was killed or he suffered under Pontius Pilate. And you're right. Other than the Virgin Mary, he's the only human that's mentioned. Although Virgin Mary, she's
a special category.
Yeah, she becomes a saint, and she's done something that's quite, so we say, more than human in parthenogenesis, a virgin birth, and I think she's. I know,
but
this,
also,
go on, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a broader point. Like, if we look at the context in which the creed was written, like every sentence has been carefully sculpted to be very precise on, you know, things like the nature of Christ. This was the statement that everyone came together and agreed, like, this is it. And you can almost see line by line, they're kind of ticking off various heresies.
Mm.
So, for example, I mean, you say, was it for us men and for our salvation? That word, for us men, was because it was originally just for our salvation, and some people started thinking that this you know, he also died for devils and Satan and things like that, and it's like no, it's just humans he died for.
Mm.
Mm. And a big issue around the time of the Nicene Creed, especially I think what we look at is what might be a slightly revised version in 381 AD,
mm.
Following the Arian heresy, which believed that Jesus was just a man.
Mm.
And so one of the things that this creed is trying to firm up is the precise nature of Jesus as both of one being with the Father, like the same substance of God, like part of the Trinity,
mm.
whilst also being incarnate as a human.
Mm.
And so that's kind of why Virgin Mary needs to be in there, to kind of explain that status,
mm.
And to resolve this theological dispute.
Mm.
Which makes it more interesting that Pontius Pilate that doesn't fulfill a kind of technical theological explanation in the same way.
Mm.
Mm. So yes, we can say the Virgin Mary is in a special category, but also her presence in the creed is
explicable
very clearly to clear up theological points.
Very good. Okay. Well, I have my theory. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
It's quite mundane. It's about dating. It's dating. Mm. That's what it is. In the ancient world, there's an irony here, that, of course, that we date everything from Christ. and so it's, you know, our dating system also refers to a sovereign, the person in charge. Mm. And that's why we call it AD, Anno Domini, Year of Our Lord. So it is how many years has Jesus been our Lord for? And that in a nutshell is how dating has always worked in the West.
Mm.
You date by ruler. I mean, okay, the Greeks dated from the first Olympic Games, and the Romans did date from the foundation of the city. But if you asked, in all Roman official documents, it will refer to the year by referring to the two consuls who were in office in that year. So say in the year in which, you know, Dave and Fred were consuls. And so, that system sort of cascaded down to the provinces. And obviously in the provinces, the local instantiation of Roman power is your governor or your prefect or whatever. And so it's quite natural to date things locally according to the local power, the local chap in charge. So, you know, you'd say, when was that? Oh, that was when, you know, Decimus was prefect. And everyone goes, ah, yes. And of course, because everybody knows when Decimus was prefect, roughly. And you say, oh, it was in the 10th year in which Decimus was prefect. And so that then, you know, puts things in a chronology. It constructs a timeline. And obviously we've talked about timelines in our Phantom Time Hypothesis episodes. So constructing a timeline that you all share is actually quite important.
And actually we see that in the Gospels as well. There's, I think, something's like in the third year of Herod's rule or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, that's just the way that people referred to time and the timeline back in the day. And so I think the reference here is to situate Jesus's the passion firmly in a historical timeline. It's to situate it within history. So, but the fact that they've decided to do that in itself, I think, is quite telling. Because it's not, they're not in the creed talking about something that is abstract. They're making the point that, no, this did happen.
Yeah, so, I mean, it starts all quite abstract and beliefy and theological. But yeah, you're right. This pins it down to this specific thing situated within our timeline. Like it happened here in this year.
Yeah, it happened during
Israel. Yeah,
during the governorship of the prefect.
Yeah,
ship.
So I think that wider point is probably more powerful than that's how timelines work there. I think, as you say, the reference grounds the events in history. And I think the wider points are important here because. So this wording has remained fixed for 1700 years. Mm. Wording only remains fixed for 1700 years if it's really good and works on a lot of levels and works over time. And I think if it was just how they did the dating back then and it served no other purpose, I think that might have been lost or it might have changed. Mm-hmm. Over literally 1,700 years, this has been used across the world, and so yeah, I think your instinct that there's a broader point anchoring this to history, that remains even as dating adventures change.
Yeah,
the abstract point that this is real, adding the focus is important.
Yeah, and it relating it to a mortal. I think that using a mortal man as the anchor, as the date anchor, works on, as you say, works on more than one level as well, because I've already made the point that it anchors Christ and the Passion into history, but it also anchors Christ to the world of men. Mm. And so I think actually having one mortal human there as a sort of a stand-in, as a placeholder for the secular world, or the world of history, the world of mankind, and you know, the edifices that he builds, you know, the empire and, you know, all of the secular power structures. And, you know, Pontius Pilate, he stands in for all of those concepts, and it anchors the passion narrative, or the Christian statement of faith to that world. It says, no, this isn't, you know, we this is something that really happened in the world, and it's linked to the world at a particular time of history. I think that it's working on those levels.
Yeah. So I fully agree with this reading, but I think we're allowed another one at the same time. As I said, like every line in this document can serve multiple purposes and have multiple readings. So, but I think another one is to draw focus onto a human being and almost place us in the narrative. Because if you read the Gospels, it is interesting how vivid a character Pontius Pilate is. Mm-hmm. A lot of the characters in the Gospels, you don't see much of them. Mm. They're not fleshed out. So some almost feel archetypical, or some are kind of just ciphers for Jesus to respond to, and things like that. But in Pilate's interrogation of Jesus, you see a real vivid human being grappling with a very difficult situation he's found himself in the middle of. He can clearly see what's right and wrong, but he also sees the wider picture. You've got the crowd starting to riot outside. You've got his position vis-a-vis the empire, you know, his relationships with the priests, with the Herods, with and yeah, he's found himself kind of at the focal point of all these things, having to make a decision. And I think by mentioning this mortal human being, who could be anyone, it kind of sucks you into it, into that story. Mm. It's almost helps you put yourself in his shoes to a certain extent, or to kind of see the world from his point of view, either for understanding or as a warning.
He's the kind of foil for Jesus, isn't he? Because he is a man, in all the ways that you've absolutely described, he is a man absolutely immersed in the concerns of this world. Mm. He's immersed in the concerns of politics, strategy, money, the practicalities of governance, all of these things. But he's very, very immersed in this world. And he's set directly into contact with Jesus Christ, the Messiah, who is very much, as he says, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. And so it's the the ambassador, the envoy, the sovereign of the kingdom that is not of this world, coming into contact with the representative of the sovereign of this world, Caesar.
Mm.
And in that sense, Pontius Pilate is standing in for something much more than just himself. He's standing in place for a world.
Mm.
The world.
The worldly world.
The worldly world, yeah. And I that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're flattering me a bit saying that's what I was saying. But it's a very good point that the focal point isn't so much him. It's the conflict between the material world and the spiritual world.
Mm.
But I think my point that you can see yourself in that narrative, yeah, perhaps you frame it as seeing ourselves in Pilate's shoes and say, picture ourselves in that place where there's a bit of a conflict between the spiritual world and the worldly world, or in that intersection, it can be difficult.
The Renaissance painters like to paint him washing his hands after the death of Jesus, after he sentences him to be crucified, and he says, you know, he washes his hands.
Yeah, but yeah, he sort of abrogates responsibility, doesn't he? He says, like, look, if you guys want this, we'll do it, but it's not my decision. Which is slightly cowardly, you might say.
I think it's also indicative of the inability of the material world or the secular power structures to handle or contain or understand Christ. So he just has to kill him and wash his hands of it.
Mm.
The two cannot interact. They cannot
it's
mesh.
Too difficult.
Yeah.
Everything's just easier if he goes away, and that easier for everyone.
So he kills him and then washes his hands.
Easier for Herod. Easier for,
But and they hit the nail on the head because, of course, he's washing his hands as if, like, right, that's it, over and done. But, of course, by killing him, he has, of course, opened the seal that will lead ultimately to the conquest of the world as it was known then by Christianity.
Mm.
So they
aren't the Romans, but
So they hit the nail on the head with that little image of him washing his hands. I think.
Yeah.
It might be worth thinking about, just because, you know, we've been talking about the difficult situation that Pilate is in and his dilemma and his strategic dilemma. It might be worth just unfolding a little bit of background about why he was actually in quite a difficult position here. There are a few things that are relevant to this. The census that is mentioned in the Gospels. Caesar Augustus, he has a census, you know, Mary and...
quite important to the story.
Yeah, Joseph and Mary have to go back to the birthplace, and, you know, it's all the whole Christmas narrative, basically.
Mm.
That census sparked off a revolt by a Jewish faction, let's say. It's called as a faction that's commonly known as the Zealots. So there was an armed insurrection against the Roman authorities off the back of this census. Now, what that shows you is that Judea is an incredibly volatile bit of the Roman Empire. It is not happy in the empire at all. And the reason it's not happy in the empire is for the very simple reason of religion. And for the Romans, this was completely discombobulating because the Romans are polytheists and everybody they've ever met.
Literally didn't care. Yeah.
They don't care. Yeah, well, they that's not quite right, actually, although I know why you said it. But they're very, very, should we say, porous and flexible with their...
Mm.
Well, they don't have dogma. That's the point. They don't have dogma. Yeah. They have practices and they do have beliefs in a sense, but they don't have dogma, they don't have orthodoxy. So when they meet other polytheists and those polytheists say, I worship Ahimotep on this hill, the Romans just say, fantastic, crack on.
Or do they almost say, that Ahimotep's probably the same as
yeah. Oh, that's Jupiter Ahimotep. Yeah. Brilliant. Let's call him Jupiter Ahimotep, and you know, we can all get along.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah.
And basically, the only thing that the Romans demanded was that you show respect to the emperor through the, should we say, the language or the ritual of sacrifice, basically, through sacred ritual, through sacred language. So in other words, you treat the emperor as semi-divine. In the provinces, really, he is a god, right? Even yeah. under the reign of Augustus, in the provinces, he's treated as a god. And you have to, and you have to show, you have to allow the emblems of imperial power, which are emblems of Jupiter, the emperor, et cetera, to be shown respect. And you have to sacrifice in the appropriate way and blah, 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 blah. And of course, yeah. other polytheists are like the Romans. They're just like, brilliant, no problem at all. You know, we worship, you know, Bogtrix the bog god. You know, maybe if you're in Northumberland or something.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But we can also worship, you know, Caesar Augustus or Caesar Tiberius or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's no conflict.
No conflict. Yeah. Brilliant. Let's crack on. But the Jewish people, of course, do not have this attitude. And we're all very familiar with the Jewish attitude because it's the attitude that we've all... Mm. It's the cultural tradition that we've inherited through the Judeo-Christian tradition. And we all know, you know, what the Judeo-Christian God says in the Old Testament is, thou shalt not have a God but me. You know, that you shall not worship false idols. You know, I am a jealous God and blah, 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 blah. And what is absolutely explicit that you must not worship other gods.
Yeah, no, that is clear.
It is clear, yeah. You know, it's kind of like page one. and note that, you know, in the Old Testament, that doesn't exclude the existence of other gods.
Well, we see Baal coming up a lot.
Exactly. So this is kind of henotheism. It's called henotheism. It's not monotheism, it's henotheism. It's where you say, yeah, there's more than one God, but we only worship one. And you know what? He's dangerous and unpredictable. So, guys, let's not screw this up. Let's just not go there. You know, he's not going to like it. and so the Romans and the Jews were stuck in this cycle of complete mutual incomprehension and antagonism because...
Well, it lasts a long time. I mean, we have so many major episodes of world history from, like, Masada, where all the... Mm. Jews had to commit suicide destruction of the temple. They went quite hard at it.
They did. You know, they really gave it a good go of causing the Romans problems. And it's, the equivalent in the modern world, perhaps it's a slightly controversial comparison, but would be something like coalition forces trying to hold on to Afghanistan. You know, they are... Afghanistan is not a powerful country. Technologically, it is, you know, nowhere in comparison to the United States. They might as well be in different centuries. and, you know, a kind of similar thing going on between Rome, you know, the metropolitan centre, and Judea, which is a bit of a backwater, I'm sorry to say. And yeah, from the Roman perspective, the fanaticism of the locals makes it very hard to hold.
It's really hard to deal with.
Really hard to deal with. And you know what? If the Judeans had had access to explosives and automatic weapons...
Yeah, they'd be all over IDs. Well, again.
And yeah,
IDs. To this day.
I mean, the Romans would have had a similar experience to the Western Afghanistan if they had. Now, luckily for the Romans... They didn't have access to explosives and firearms and so forth. And it is a little bit easier to manage these things when you can't really kill from a distance. You have to do your killing up close because it means that you can kind of keep a lid on it. They don't have the force multiplier of explosives and firearms and so forth. But even then, you know, it takes the best part of, nearly a century to really get a grip on this little area, and it sucks in a lot of Roman effort. And so anyway, a few decades before Pilate gets there, there'd been this big revolt under Augustus. There's a lot of antagonism between the locals and the Romans. And Tiberius himself, it's worth thinking about Tiberius. So Tiberius is the first real Roman emperor, in a sense. Now, obviously, Augustus is the Roman emperor. But in the same way that Adam is kind of only half a human being because he wasn't born, you know, the first real human beings are Cain and Abel because they are born, right?
Yeah.
And so Tiberius, in the same way, is the first emperor because he's the first person that succeeds to the throne.
An existing institution,
exactly. Now, that puts him in quite a difficult position because the norms, the rules, the structures are not set in stone yet in quite the same way as they would be in later decades and centuries. So he's kind of feeling his way. And really, Tiberius at heart is not... he's not a monarch. He's not a monarchist. He's a republican. He's a patrician. He's old school. He finds all of this kind of monarch stuff contemptible, and so he's in this rather invidious position of being the monarch by force of circumstance. And he doesn't really have an option. There is no option. There has to be a monarch, and it has to be him, for various reasons that we don't need to go into. And yet he finds the way he's treated utterly contemptible. He finds all these people flattering him and being servile towards him, Romans, proud Romans, treating him as if he's a king, to be utterly, utterly risible and contemptible. He cannot bear it, and the cognitive dissonance and the tensions, they're really hard at work on him. And he's an old man and he's quite bitter. He's been quite badly treated by Augustus through his life. But on the other hand, he's an incredibly capable military man and administrator. So he's not, he's not weak or anything like that.
He's not decadent yet.
A real grown-up. But that made him very, very difficult to deal with as an emperor if you're one of his administrators. Mm. Because he is the monarch. He is the emperor. He has absolute power. But he doesn't want you to treat him like that. But also, if you get it wrong, he will kill you. he is an absolute ruler, but if you treat him like he is an absolute ruler, he will possibly kill you. But if you don't treat him like he's an absolute ruler, then he will possibly kill you, which is not a comfortable kind of headspace.
You can't relax in that environment.
You cannot relax at all. But what Tiberius liked to do is he liked to give people quite ambivalent instructions. He liked to be ambivalent. He liked to kind of hold his cards close to his chest, have a look at what people did, and then either say, well done, or...
you fulfilled my instructions. Yeah.
Off to the cells with you, my friend. Bad. That's not what I wanted at all. And I think you had a lot of this phenomenon that you see with a lot of dictators, people working towards the perceived wishes of the dictator.
Yeah, so trying to guess what he wants.
Guess what he wants and do it. And Tiberius is very canny. So what he would say is this is pure speculation, but this is the kind of thing, according to our sources, that Tiberius would do. And our main sources here really are Tacitus and the like. Tiberius would say, he's probably said to Pontius Pilate something along the lines of, I want you to be prefect of Judea. Of course, sir. What are the key objectives here? What do you want me to achieve? And Tiberius has said, don't be ridiculous, man. I want you to be a Roman prefect. Keep them in line. Show them who's boss. Now, be gone with you. Stop wasting my time. Ridiculous question. What should I do? Why are you asking me? Go and get on with it. Are you a Roman? That's what he'll have said. Something like that, right? And Pontius Pilate will have, felt a little bit terrified just in case, that was the end there and then. And he'll have gone and think, right, he wants me to bring these strange peoples, the Jews, into line. He wants me to take the situation by the scruff of the neck and get them, singing from the correct hymn sheet. And so that's where you get this really strange story that's repeated in both Josephus and Philo about what Pilate does when he arrives in post, which is that he brings the legionary standards into Jerusalem. Now, the legionary standards are emblems of Jupiter, but also kind of the emperor. It's a bit garbled, but they are religiously significant objects that are idols. They're idols. That's how the Jewish tradition would see
it.
That's what an idol is. It's a thing that's a god or that's sacred. And he places them in the holy city. And this basically causes a lot of consternation.
It's a powerful start.
But I think you can see in that when he first gets there, he's thinking, right, I'm going to grab these people. I'm going to show them who's boss immediately. I'm going to place the standards in the middle of Jerusalem. you know, the holy city, and they're gonna come and pay their respects. And you get this story that he surrounded all the great mob or crowd, should we say? I'll use a slightly less triggering language that came out to, you know, protest against this. He surrounds them with a sort of triple rank of soldiers who then draw their swords, and he says, "You need to pay your respects to these now, or you're all going to die." And supposedly they all sort of bared their necks and said, "Right, strike us down then. We'd much rather die than pay our respects to these idols." At which point he's supposed to have relented and said, "Bloody hell, all right, fine, I'll take them out."
Okay, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, because of course, if he on day one of his new role, he massacres a load of, you know, civilians in the middle of the holy city, he knows what's going to happen. The whole area is going to immediately explode in revolt. And that and he's going to be thinking, well, that's not what Tiberius wants. He wants me to get them in, but he doesn't want me to have to cause a problem where he's got to send, you know, two or three precious legions from elsewhere.
What he wants is never hear about Judea.
he wants to not hear about Judea. And so in a perfect example, you can see how Pontius Pilate comes in as this kind of probably quite bluff military man who's thinking, right, Tiberius wants me to do X, gets there, has his first contact with the complexities of the situation and what dealing with, you know, the Judeans is like, and suddenly realizes that it's actually going to be quite tricky. And I think you can see that happen again. The perfect parallel of that story about the legionary standards in Judea is the story of Christ when he comes to see him, because I'm sure that Pontius Pilate would have loved to just use some executive power and just deal with the problem. But he knows that if he gets it wrong and he causes some kind of fracas or rebellion or whatever, Tiberius is not going to be pleased. But if he doesn't get it right and he doesn't suppress it and make it all go away, Tiberius is not going to be pleased. And it's not clear which was the right thing for him to do. And he's between a rock and a hard place. And you can really see this is the situation he was in, because that's how his governorship ends. And we talked about this at the beginning of the podcast, that he goes, you know, there's a minor rebellion up in a mountain somewhere, and he goes after them, and he brings the hammer down of Roman military power, and he kills a lot of them. And then suddenly he finds himself, you know, recalled, sort of sent back to Rome to answer for what he's done.
That's what he wanted.
Yeah, it's like, come on, guys, like, what am I supposed to do? I think that he must have been quite a quick learner, because he stays in post for a long time, and it's not an easy post at all. And I think that in the how he deals with Christ, you can see how he did that, which is that he tries to be emollient. He tries to find the path of least resistance. He tries to fudge the issue. You know, when he says, "I'll just flog him and then let him go," he's already said he's not guilty of anything. But, you know, I can see you're angry. I'll give him a bit of a flogging and then I'll give him back to you. Is that not good enough? Come on, guys. Like, you know, let's all be friends. You can see in that kind of, that's his approach. So I think possibly when we say he's a well-drawn character in the Gospels, I think he was probably quite...
impressive guy.
He was probably quite a... He was a person who probably was a well-known character.
Yeah.
Or a memorable character, because of his approach and his wiliness and his slight slipperiness, but also his adaptability in post.
Yeah, and I think my understanding is he worked quite closely with Caiaphas and kept him in place as high priest, which was his role to allocate for like 5 years or something, which was unusual. And so I think he'd sort of created quite good relationships with community leaders, to use that modern term.
Hearts and minds, boys. Hearts and minds.
But obviously that has to go both ways.
Yeah.
And also we shouldn't forget, if you've got a kind of large crowd outside your office starting to get fractious, there's a kind of animal threat happening there as well. And especially back then as well, when you didn't have barbed wire and machine guns. It's like,
I mean, how many troops has he got with him?
Palace, so,
50? It's not going to be enough against 1,000, let alone 5,000. So yeah, there is that as well. He actually needs to keep the peace in order to preserve his own life, probably in those situations, or at least it will have felt like that. Yeah. So I think that is hopefully that's a bit of background context on why he might have acted in the way he did in The Passion. Mm. That's enlightening. I've read all kinds of interesting things online though about Pilate. You know, some people are saying, "Oh no, he was very, he must have been very pro-Jewish." And other people are being like, no, he's clearly an anti-Semite. Like, look at what he did, you know, setting these things up in the temple. And he's saying, no, but then, you know, then he took pity and he let them go. He's clearly a, you know, a Phil Semite or, you know, whatever. And I did notice that not many of them are really thinking about of these commentators online in the sort of biblical commentary kind of space, at least that's easily accessible
it's
online.
A dangerous world, yeah.
They're not really, they're very much thinking of it from the, I guess, from the Jewish point of view rather than the Roman point of view. And if you think about it from the Roman point of view, he's not an anti-Semite. He's also not a philo-Semite. He's a polytheist.
He's a pragmatist. He's trying to keep it together.
Yeah,
the minutiae of colonial government.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's just trying to kind of get you know, put one foot in front of the other day to day.
And that's the angle I really like on him, because that's where we can see ourselves in his position. We're just trying to make it through the day causing any disasters, but then sometimes just presented with some terrible choice between two terrible things. It's like
some massive outside context problem like comes in. It's like you can imagine, can't you? You're responsible for the implementation of some policy at work, and then somebody like wanders in being like, well, I am actually the son of God and I'm afraid that your policy doesn't apply to me. What do you do? I guess I'll call the police and go and wash my hands. I don't know.
he appears as a character in Bulgakov's novel The Master and Margarita, which is a sort of Russian dissident text from the 40s, I think, which is a brilliant book. But there's a sort of story within the story where one of the main characters is an author who's writing an account of Pilate's relationship with Jesus. And he takes quite a sympathetic line on Pilate, but one of the bits of characterization is that Pilate is just trying to get through the day, but the only person he really trusts is his dog.
Yeah.
He loves his dog.
Yeah. Do you think that I wonder what language they would have spoken to each other, Christ and Pilate? It's an interesting question. I wonder whether it would have been Greek.
Ooh.
Pilate learned Aramaic, that's good kind
of. That would be to his credit, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That would be to his credit. Whether he had an inter, of course, you know, the Gospels might just elide the interpreter, of course. That's an interesting question.
But it would hit different with an interpreter in the room.
It would.
Because it feels so immediate and direct.
I mean, Pilate will almost certainly have spoken Greek. I mean, he'll obviously have spoken Latin, but he will almost certainly have been fluent in Greek. I don't know. Do we know anything about Christ, the languages that Christ spoke? I mean, I know he will have spoken Aramaic. I know that. Yeah, but would he have known Greek? Probably not, because he's from Galilee, isn't he? That's the backwater of a backwater. Although he is quite educated. But would he be educated in the...
Yeah, I mean, some of his disciples and people around him would have been in Greek. And, of course, we have the Gospels written by either his followers or followers of followers. And they're in very good Greek.
We're generally far better at knowing lots of different languages in the ancient world.
There'd be no conflict between having Aramaic as your day-to-day language and then Greek as the prestige. And then, I guess, Hebrew if you're in the temple all the time.
Mm. An interesting question. I wonder if anybody's ever looked into that or whether we're missing something obvious. But
I refuse to Google.
I'll Google later. I'll do it later. But we'll leave it as a mystery. It's good to have mysteries on Easter.
It is.
Isn't it?
It is.
So, final and most important questions then, unless there's anything else you want to add. Do you do Easter eggs?
Obviously I'm still on my Get Jacked quest.
Project.
Which has been very thematic with Lent. I've been fasting.
Yes.
But I did allow myself two small Easter eggs today.
Ooh.
And a slice of simnel cake. Nice. And a slice of Christmas pudding. Because you do the thing where you make two crisps pudding. Yeah, and now I'm feeling disgusting.
You went for it.
I also had my first glass of wine this year.
Wow. Wow. Truly, the world has been reborn today.
It's a feast day.
Yep.
And we're rejoicing.
That is nice.
But now I'm feeling ashamed.
There's no need to feel ashamed. Jesus wants you to eat the Easter eggs. That's the point. I think that's the message of Easter, isn't it? That Christ, you know, he died such that we might eat chocolate in the shape of an egg. And he...
Well, I think in much of the world, that is how it's been received.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I wouldn't worry. Project Get Shredded is clearly going well.
We'll be back on track tomorrow.
Yep. Yeah, very good. Well, on that happy note, perhaps we should leave it there.
Yeah,
very good.
Stay jacked.
Happy Easter.